Would you please stand and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance? I may have.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, and justice for all.
Madam Clerk, could you call the roll, please?
Mr. Thomas?
Here.
Mr. Pitzer? Ms. Peters?
Here.
Mr. Treese?
Present.
Mr. Ruffin?
Here.
Mr. Trapp?
Here.
Mr. Scala?
We are down two council members, which should significantly reduce the time that we spend. And if there's a perception that we're moving left of center, it all depends on your view of the dais. Do we have minutes from the October 1st meeting?
Yes.
And has everyone had a chance to review those? Is there any corrections, additions, deletions, amendments? Mr. Trapp?
I would move to approve.
Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Ms. Peters. All those in favor of approving the minutes as distributed indicate by saying aye.
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 Anyone opposed? Seeing none. And did we have the September 17th minutes?
You all take
we
care
already
of that
took care
previously.
Of that. Thank you very much. Are there any adjustments to tonight's agenda, including the consent agenda? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving the agenda as distributed indicate by saying, is there a motion to approve?
So moved.
Seconded by Ms. Peters. All those in favor of approving the agenda as distributed indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Seeing none, the agenda is approved. We have one special item tonight. Is someone here from the Nora Stewart preschool organization? Good evening. How about you stand right there so the microphone can pick everything up. Good evening.
Good evening. My name is Cheryl Howard. I'm the director of Nora Stewart Early Learning Center. I'm going to give you a brief history of Nora Stewart. For those who do not know about Nora Stewart, was a fine little jewel hidden. So we've been around for 80 years. We started out in a single family home. We moved to a church location, and now where we're at now for over 33 years. Nora Stewart started off as a Negro nursery school. It name changed to Nora Stewart Memorial Nursery School. It is now Nora Stewart Early Learning Center. We house approximately 30 to 40 children. We're licensed for 60 some children. Our enrollment is slightly down today, and a program that we're presenting to you today hopefully will increase enrollment, which will increase our funding for Nora Stewart. Judy Hubbard will give you the outline of the proposal.
Mayor and City Council members, thank you for your attention to this matter because I just want to say, first of all, that the strategic plan has been really improving our neighborhoods that we've targeted, and that in turn helps the city. And Nora Stewart is in the first ward. That is a big part of our strategic plan. And we have many issues in that area that need to be addressed. We have a lot of single parent homes, fatherless children, poverty, working poor, crime, drug trafficking, and high addiction rates, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of that does revolve around the drug scene and drug and alcohol abuse. We would like to propose at Nora Stewart that we offer the City of Columbia the Creating Lasting Family Connections program. That is a drug and alcohol prevention program for parents and children. And the reason why this is so important, and I've had experience in this, I taught it for 3 years. It was funded by the state of Missouri. But it's the one, it's the best practice model in SAMHSA. That's a Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Association. And it helps many individuals and families by offering help with group, parent, and youth classes targeted at drug and alcohol abuse. I know this works. I know you know it works, Mike, but we need to offer the families, in particular at Nora Stewart, but in the First Ward, and anybody else who would like to come to those classes, because this program really hits at the belly of the beast as far as the drug scene and the alcohol scene and all the issues involved with it, because of domestic violence, sexual violence, the crime rate, home invasions, all our shootings. A lot of those things are directly related to the drug scene or alcohol scene. And where does that begin? It begins in the belly of the beast, which is the home. If you think back to your childhood, you might not have had any alcohol or drugs in your family at all. We didn't. And so it wasn't until it was much later, you know, that I even came into contact with that. But a lot of homes, and I'm thinking of a young man in the First Ward. I met him when he was 2.5 years old. And he was born in one of the Missouri prisons because his mother was a crack addict and she had been sentenced to prison for drug-related charges. So when he was born, he was sent home with the grandparents and they raised him. Because his mom was an addict, he was a crack baby. So he already had some mental and emotional and chemistry things going on with him that wasn't really helpful in his life. But then he's in a home and in a neighborhood where drugs sometimes are the second economy in the neighborhood. He's 22 now, and I still love him to pieces. But that's one reason why I'm speaking tonight, is because I know that he didn't get the help he needed, and his family didn't get the help that he needed because they were at risk. And it's so important that somehow we help people who are most at risk to make a paradigm shift in their thinking about drug and alcohol abuse and prevention of that. He's been in and out of jail. He's had problems because of his family's history with all of that. And I think we would have, like, this program is one night you teach the parents all by themselves, and one night you teach the children. And it's very up-to-date information, the latest we can get about drug and alcohol abuse and all the things that follow it. But one of the things that we do is many of the parents themselves have grown up and had their ideas about drug and alcohol and that lifestyle. They've formed that, and they may not, nobody may have ever even sat them down and talked to them about it. But children are very bright, and they just soak up everything around them like a sponge. So if you see your mother and she's an addict, but you know your mother loves you, it can't be that bad, can it? If you see your uncle who's selling on the corner, you know that, you know, he's your uncle and he's always playing ball or doing something. Everybody looks up to him, so it can't be that bad, can it? And what this program does is, one, I'll give you one example. If you were in the class we would be in, and it's highly confidential, what stays is said there stays there, we would ask you what mealtime was like when you were a small child. And so you would draw a diagram of that. And then we would go around and everybody can share that. Lots of issues come out when you share about mealtime. Well, we didn't really have mealtime because my mom always worked and we didn't have a dad, or we would, you know, sometimes we would have food, sometimes we wouldn't. Sometimes my dad would come in and take the money for food, for drugs or whatever, all sorts of issues. And so when we're sharing in this parent group, they start breaking down the barriers. And I'm telling you, I've had drug dealers and addicts in my parent groups, and they have literally broken down because they have never talked about some of these issues. And so when they're sitting there and talking about this, then we help them to make that paradigm shift and say, see, you have children now, and they're watching what you do, and they're taking it all in. Whether you never shoot up in front of them or not, they take it all in, and it forms their opinion. So that's what makes this program so effective, I think, is that we really give the parents and the adults the help they need to address issues about drug and alcohol abuse that they've never addressed. And then the children, we can start with them and help build a healthy attitude about that. The man, Ted Strader, who is the one who wrote all the material in the program, it's such a great program that first in Kentucky, they make it mandatory in their corrections system that each person coming out of prison has to take this. And then when they get out, they have to be a part of this also to give them the help they need. This would help our families, not only at Nora Stewart, but we can do this citywide. We can do it anywhere for anybody who needs it. It's just that I think first if we could address the most at-risk families, that would be the most helpful. And I'm not pointing fingers or anything. I want to go on record as saying I have four children. My husband and I had four children. And when they became teenagers, all four of them, in one way or another, were involved in the drug scene. We were just very blessed by God that they got through that. But we had the support, and we had people backing us up to help us work through all of that and get them back on the right path. A lot of people that I know didn't even have that when they were children. Now they're parents, and they can't give their children what they haven't had. So I think it's very important that we do that. In this Creating Lasting Family Connections, there are three parts to it. There's the original family connections. It's for the parents and the youth. And then there is family reintegration, and that's designed for fathers to come into the home, even if they're not living in the home, but to have a relationship with their children, in particular fathers who are returning from prison. And in our strategic plan and across the city, we have many fathers who are reentering and need to reconnect with their children. And then another part is marriage enhancement program, which is to help people build good, strong marriages. And as you know, in the strategic plan, we've had, let's see, high school graduations are up, marriages are up, home ownership is up, and unemployment is way down in our strategic plan areas. And so I think it's really important that since we're on a real positive path here, that we bring in resources which would really give them the tools. We can throw a lot of money at addictions and helping aftercare. But it's so much better because an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And so if we can get people and children before they get into that cycle, or even if they're in that cycle, help make that shift in their thinking, it would really enrich the lives of the families at Nora Stewart, in the First Ward, in the strategic plan, and in the city of Columbia.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Mayor Treese.
Mr. Ruffin.
I would like to reserve an opportunity to respond to this proposal at the end of the council meeting today.
Okay, sounds great. Thank you. Next to order of business will be appointments to boards and commissions. There are several opportunities to volunteer your expertise on a number of boards and commissions. Our first such slot is the Building Construction Codes Commission. There is one vacancy in the alternate position for which there are no applicants, and without objection, we will re-advertise. On the Citizens Police Review Board, there are three vacancies. We have a number of applicants. Madam Clerk, would you call the roll for the first vacancy?
Mr. Thomas?
Valdebruntz.
Ms. Peters?
Valdebruntz.
Mr. Treese?
Valdebruntz.
Mr. Ruffin?
Valdebruntz.
Mr. Trapp?
Valdebruntz.
And for the second vacancy?
Mr. Thomas?
Andrew Fisher.
Ms. Peters?
I'm Andrew Fisher.
Mr. Treese?
Mr. Fisher.
Mr. Ruffin?
Andrew Fisher.
Mr. Trapp?
Andrew Fisher.
And for the third expired term?
Mr. Thomas?
Tammy Gibson.
Ms. Peters?
Travis Pringle.
Mr. Treese?
Travis Pringle.
Mr. Ruffin?
Travis Pringle.
Mr. Trapp?
Travis Pringle.
And having achieved four, congratulations, Mr. Pringle. For the Columbia Community Development Commission, there are two vacancies for the fourth ward expired term. Madam Clerk?
Mr. Thomas?
Michael Fletcher.
Ms. Peters?
Michael Fletcher.
Mr. Treese?
Michael Fletcher.
Mr. Ruffin?
Michael Fletcher.
Mr. Trapp?
Michael Fletcher.
And for the at-large, Madam Clerk?
Mr. Thomas?
Nicholas Knoth.
Ms. Peters?
Nicholas Knoth.
Mr. Treese?
Nicholas Knoth.
Mr. Ruffin?
Nicholas Knoth.
Mr. Trapp?
Nicholas Knoth.
And for the Commission on Cultural Affairs, looks like there are four slots of expired terms and a net of four applicants. May I suggest that we reappoint the four applicants for those four vacancies? Without objection, they are appointed. For the Disabilities Commission, there's one vacancy and no applicants, and I would suggest that we re-advertise. For the Personnel Advisory Board, Madam Clerk, there's one vacancy and two applicants.
Mr. Thomas?
Angela Crumbliss.
Ms. Peters?
Angela Crumbliss.
Mr. Treese?
Angela Crumbliss.
Mr. Ruffin?
Angela Crumbliss.
Mr. Trapp?
Angela Crumbliss.
And for the Substance Abuse Advisory Board, there are two vacancies and three applicants. Madam Clerk, for the first one?
Mr. Thomas?
Anne Eisenbeiss.
Ms. Peters?
Anne Eisenbeiss.
Mr. Treese?
Molly Lindner.
Mr. Ruffin?
Molly Lindner.
Mr. Trapp?
Molly Lindner.
So why don't you call that one again?
And we'll start with Ms. Peters this time. Ms. Peters?
Molly Lindner.
Mr. Treese?
Molly Lindner.
Mr. Ruffin?
Molly Lindner.
Mr. Trapp?
Molly Lindner.
Mr. Thomas?
And Eisenbeiss.
Ms. Lindner received four.
Thank you. And for the second vacancy, please.
Mr. Thomas?
And Eisenbeiss.
Ms. Peters?
And Eisenbeiss.
Mr. Treese?
And Eisenbeiss.
Mr. Ruffin?
And Eisenbeiss.
Mr. Trapp?
And Eisenbeiss.
And for the Tax Increment Finance Commission, that's a mayor's appointment with consent of council. There's three vacancies there, two applicants. Without objection, I don't think there's any pressing issue. Can we re-advertise that until we get a full slate of candidates there? Moving on to schedule public comment. Those that want to address council prior to our regular order of business can contact the city clerk's office on Wednesday before the agenda goes out. We have four such scheduled public comment. Our first is Mr. Timothy Love. Sir, how are you this evening? Good. Welcome.
So my name is Timothy Love. I'm a PhD graduate student in English literature at the University of Missouri. I just want to start off by saying that racism is a reality, okay? That it is a reality in the world. It is a reality in this country, and it is a reality in this state. There is not a possibility that somehow racism avoided this state or this city. Okay? It was a reality in 1923 when James T. Scott was lynched by residents of this city, and it is a reality now. But you don't have to lynch someone, or you don't have to be a neo-Nazi or a Klans member to be guilty of racism. No, ordinary individuals like yourselves are capable of implicit bias. whether that implicit bias emerges voluntarily or involuntarily. It is possible that seemingly good, kind people, law-abiding people, can sometimes or habitually make the mistake of prejudging people based on the color of their skin. Yes, believe it or not, it happens. It happens outside of work. It happens on the job. It happens in our homes. It happens in office buildings here downtown. It happens in the University of Missouri classrooms. It happens in Missouri courtrooms. It happens in Missouri jails, Missouri prisons, in the back of Missouri police vehicles, and before one is pulled over by a cop. Implicit bias is so common that it sometimes is often mistaken for good judgment or a necessary value that contributes to effective law enforcement. But no matter how much we wish to justify implicit bias, no matter how much we want to believe that, for instance, certain races simply commit more crime, or that certain races are more violent than others, or that certain areas of town where certain ethnic groups reside are more dangerous, arresting certain ethnic groups throughout the state at a very high rate and imprisoning these ethnic groups disproportionately simply reflects a long culture of bias. It reflects patterns indicative of historical American racism, not rational judgment. We are not, but I guess I'll just ask this question, but how can we get more people, more people who are not normally victims of implicit bias, privileged individuals, how can we get them to admit to practicing this? How can we get privileged officers or prosecutors? How can we get individuals like yourselves to admit to possible implicit bias? How can we get you to say that I did this and I messed up, I was wrong? How can we also convince all of these people that admitting to implicit bias is the first and absolutely necessary step if we ever want to change things? I mean, let's face it, admitting to implicit bias is not the end of the world. On the contrary, admitting to racism can be a huge first step toward racial diversity and racial harmony throughout this state. I know this to be true. A lot of us know this to be true. Yet accusations of implicit bias, of systemic racism, are often undermined, downplayed, haphazardly disproved, or dismissed. People don't want to normally admit to racism, even at its smallest degree. There are too many people today who would rather accuse marginalized individuals of crying wolf. There are too many people that don't realize or would not rather realize the possibility of their own prejudicial flaws. Instead of accusing, for instance, black people of entitlement, instead of accusing black people of feeling that the world owes them something, perhaps we can consider the possibility that most black people are not crying wolf, that most black people are not weaponizing victimization. Yes, we know all the numbers. We know that black drivers here in Boone County are four times more likely to be pulled over than white drivers. We know that although blacks make up only 10% of this city, that 20% of all that 20% of all people pulled over by cops are black. Okay, we know the numbers. Okay, we know that whites are underrepresented in police arrests in this city, and blacks are overrepresented. Yet we refuse to blame racism. In response to these numbers, there were many officers last year and currently that say that these numbers are misleading because of so many things play into it. An officer was on record, a high-ranking officer was on record saying I can honestly say I don't think we've had a problem over the years, okay? But, and also, there are many officers that believe that they should police more area, they should police areas more so in which crime is most reported. And it just so happens that those areas are mostly, populated by African Americans. But I just want all of you to, think of the fact, think of the possibility that in areas that are not heavily policed, that crime, that basically just because an area is not policed, that does not mean crime is going on. All right. There's absolutely no scientific data, no empirical data to affirm that black people have some type of natural proclivity to commit crime. But there is ample data to suggest that blacks are scrutinized more, profiled more, interrogated more, arrested more, falsely accused more, and incarcerated for longer periods of time because of systemic racism. Myself, I've only lived here for a little over 3 years. And I must say that I thoroughly believe that I've been targeted way too much because of the color of my skin. And I'm not crying wolf. I'm not saying this just to have a voice. A few months ago, I was pulled over by a white Missouri highway patrolman on Highway 70. And because of the oddity of the patrol stop, I simply asked him in a respectful manner, "Did you pull me over because I'm black?" And he said, "Sir, there's no such thing as police bias." Days later, two white cops from the University of Missouri questioned me for sitting in my own car in front of my own parking lot in my apartment complex, interrogated me. I'm asking them as they're interrogating me, what am I doing? Am I doing anything wrong? Then I finally asked them, "Are you doing this because I'm black?" And one officer said, "Don't mention racism. If you mention racism, it's only going to piss me off." Okay. Not too long after these incidents, I find myself in a Missouri courtroom contesting yet another traffic ticket in front of a white judge. A white prosecutor said, as she was holding my citation record in her hand, asked me if I have any idea why I've been pulled over so much. I said, "Perhaps it's because I'm black." And she says, "Don't you dare mention race in this courtroom. Don't you dare try to pull the race card." Okay? As I'm trying to tell her why I'm saying this, the judge screams at me and says, "Don't raise my voice in the courtroom," although I was not raising my voice. This past summer, on a Friday night in downtown Columbia, I witnessed a Columbia police officer drive his patrol car very speedily toward a group of black children. He abruptly stopped at a curb right in front of them, scaring many of them and myself also. The officer immediately exited his car and began to interrogate this group of children that couldn't have been any more from 9 to 12 years old. I asked the officer why he was bothering these children, because they seemed to be peacefully hanging out on the street. I was watching them for the past hour. And he claimed that someone had called in a complaint. When one of the children raised the possibility of police bias or racial profiling, the officer got extremely angry. And I was just wondering at that time if that entire situation would have been different if those group of kids were white. In February, I was summoned to jury duty right here in Columbia. The accused, or the defendant, was a black male. And believe it or not, I was the only black person in a jury pool of 100 predominantly white jurors that was summoned that day. Right there in the courtroom, I asked the judge why I was the only black juror present. This man is supposed to have a jury of his peers. She said that jurors were randomly selected by computer I responded, "Do you think that's fair, Judge?" And she said she was not allowed to have an opinion. Okay. Then I adamantly expressed the importance of having a diverse jury in cases where, especially in cases where the defendant is black. I've experienced more racism in this state, in this town, than I've ever experienced before in my life.
Dr. Love?
Yes.
I appreciate you sharing your personal experience.
Way over time, 6 minutes. So sorry about
that's
that.
That's right. And I want to be fair to everyone else that has signed up as well. I know you have written comments, and if you want to share those
sure.
with the clerk,
thank
I'll
you
make
very
sure
much.
That.
And I'm sorry for going over time.
You're great. I appreciate your eloquence and your
thank you very much.
Of course. Thank you very much.
All right,
and I'll make sure the other council members get that as
no
well
problem
who aren't
at all.
Here as well.
Okay, great.
Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Nathan Hurtado. Hurtado? You can have Mr. Hurtado's time. Mr. Ash, Donald Ash. Is Donald Ash here? Okay. Our last speaker would be Rebecca Shaw, and I see Ms. Shaw. Thank you. Good evening. Again.
City Council members and Mr. Mathis, I'm here tonight as a citizen and also to represent the group members of Como for Progress, some of whom are here. And if you are here, would you stand if you're here to talk about the community-oriented policing? Many of these people attended community forums and have a vested interest in seeing community-oriented policing in Columbia. This council issued a directive to the city manager to design a citywide community-oriented policing program for the Columbia Police Department, as well as a transition plan. I don't want to rehash everything pointed out by the public at the previous meeting, but I believe the point was made repeatedly that this was not a plan, which was what the public and this council asked for. This was an outline to a ballot initiative from the city manager. Myself and others previously came to this council after attending the city's forums on community policing and voiced concerns that forum attendees were left with the impression that city leadership was more interested in securing funds than understanding the needs of this community. At the July 2nd council meeting, Lynn Maloney of RMF stated, "The deflection away from community-oriented policing policy toward cost of adding police officers at meetings is eroding trust. It came as no surprise to many of us that this report begins with Manager Mathis's hand out asking for money and does little to describe what actions are necessary to help our police force grow into an organization that will protect and serve all of our diverse community." In the opening pages of the document, this tone is taken repeatedly. The community must provide the resources. The community only has to commit to it or decide that they simply won't pay for it. Should resources be available? During discussion by council following public comment, many council members pointed out that there was no mention of the way to build shared trust and values with the community. Some of you pointed to this being a foundational document. Only one member made a strong statement that made it clear that this was not what was asked for and they would not support a ballot measure. Seeing such swift backlash against Mr. Thomas from the CPOA president for this statement only underlies for me the us versus them mentality Mr. Thomas was discussing in that statement. His statement reflected the current and past culture of institutionalized racism in this country and how our community will have to work to change it. If council cannot openly discuss the racial climate in this country without pushback from officers, how do we move this resolution forward in this community? I hope that in the 60-day extension you've given Mr. Mathis to edit this draft with suggestions from the public and council members, we'll see something that takes a very different tone and reflects what community policing means to the people of this city. To date, so far, I've not seen the online submission form that was requested at the previous council on the city's website for public comment. If the council's resolution, a step celebrated by many, becomes nothing more than another money grab by the city manager, the city will have another failed ballot measure, and the council's inaction of denouncing this plea for money, disguised as a plan, will further erode trust between the public and the people whose job it is to represent them. Don't let Mr. Mathis ruin what was a very good thing.
Thank you very much. Moving on to public hearings. Madam Clerk, would you call public hearing 38-18?
Public hearing 38-18 is the voluntary annexation of property located on the east side of Bearfield Road, approximately 1,400 feet north of Gans Road.
Thank you. Do we have a staff report? This is a public hearing only. There will not be a vote on this issue. Director?
Yes. Thank you, Mayor. Good evening. This is property with a common address of 5705 East Mexico Gravel. Oh, I beg your pardon. Wrong address. This is property that is on Bearfield Road. Apologize for that error. It's known as the Easley Valley View Gardens and Bristol Lakes HOA properties. It's a combination of three ownerships, so we have three different voluntary annexation petitions. There will be items that are related that are on your agenda November 5th. They're not marked with an asterisk, so those will be items that will be under the old business section of the agenda. That'd be the annexation and rezoning ordinance, and also the preliminary plat approval for a subdivision. This is an area that is contiguous to the city on the south boundary. It's on the east side of Bearfield Road, which is maintained by Boone County. All utilities will be provided by the city, so that's water and electric, wastewater collection and treatment, and then, of course, refuse collection and police protection and fire protection will be extended to the site. The Boone County Fire Protection District does have dual jurisdiction in this area. And it is in the urban service area as well. There are sewer facilities that actually cross the site, so there is available infrastructure, and there will be a development agreement that attaches to the preliminary plat approval. I'll try to answer any questions.
Any questions for the Community Development Department? Seeing none, is there anyone from the applicant that would like to present to council? Mr. Crockett, good evening.
Good evening. Mayor and members of council, Tim Crockett, Crockett Engineering, 1000 West Nifong. As Mr. Teddy indicated, this proposal comes to you again in 2 weeks with the preliminary plat and the zoning as well. So I will reserve my comments and presentation at that time so it can be a package presentation, but I'm happy to answer any questions that pertain to the annexation at this time.
Have you anticipated any of my questions?
I have not anticipated them yet. No.
Very good. Are any questions for Mr. Crockett or the applicant at this point? Seeing none, thank you very much for being here. Is there anyone from the public that would like to be heard on the voluntary annexation of property located on the east side of Bearfield Road and Gans Road? Anyone from the public would like to be heard? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on public hearing 38-18. Madam Clerk, would you read the consent agenda again?
Items on the consent agenda include bills 239-18, 242-18, 243-18, 244-18, 245-18, 246-18, 247-18, and 248-18, and resolutions 158-18, 159-18, 160-18, 161-18, 162-18, 163-18, and 164-18.
And then, Madam Clerk, could you read the consent agenda again and then call the roll?
Bills 239-18, 242-18, 243-18, 244-18, 245-18, 246-18, 247-18, 248-18, and resolutions 158-18, 159-18, 160-18, 161-18, 162-18, 163-18, 164-18. Mr. Thomas.
Yes.
Ms. Peters.
Yes.
Mr. Treese.
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin.
Yes.
Mr. Trapp.
Yes.
Those yeses are easy. How about introduction?
We're wearing on you, aren't we, Mayor?
How about introduction and first reading, Madam Clerk? We're doing so good.
All bills are introduced by the mayor unless otherwise indicated. Bills 240-18, 241-18, 249-18, 250-18, 251-18, 252-18, 253-18, 254-18, 255-18, 256-18, 257-18, 258-18, 259-18, 260-18, 261-18, 262-18, 263-18, 264-18, 265-18, 266-18, 267-18, 268-18, 269-18, 270-18, 271-18, 272-18, and 273-18, first reading.
Very good. Thank you very much. Moving on to reports. Our first report is Report 88-18 from the Boone County Commission. Does anybody have any questions? I think, Ms. Peters, you had asked this to come forward as a result of a letter that we had all received. And it looks like staff has no objection to removal of the curb cut and I think a tree and a couple parking spaces, even though it costs us significant taxpayer money. Any further discussion on this report? Mr. Thomas.
Yeah, I saw, I think, in the letter from the commission an offer to plant another tree to replace the one that would be removed, and I would suggest we ask them to do that.
Okay.
Any further comment?
Do we need to do something to let them know we're okay with this, or?
Mr. Trapp, did you have a?
I mean, I'm torn on it because the county is our partners, and I appreciate them, you know, wanting to serve. But it seems an odd storing salt trucks downtown, especially when they're not really used on city streets. Because, right, is my understanding, the county only salts outside of the. So it seems like the county serves a donut, and to put their salt trucks in the middle of the donut hole downtown seems a strange use of the property. So, you know, so I have some conflicted feelings about it, and was looking forward to
I think they could use them for their parking lots and sidewalks and around their governmental properties, but I haven't had a conversation about them, but
So it's more like, okay, makes sense.
They own quite a few parking lots, and that's where they'd house their equipment.
So it would be for their downtown. Okay, that makes more sense. So we're not talking about the big trucks for the roads, but gators and those kinds of
equipment. No, it's for the citizens that utilize the government center and the various properties they own and those kinds of things.
Well, that seems more appropriate. I know we do similar functions in downtown.
Yeah, we have ours in our garage. So
where would might not be a function that we would look the private sector to serve downtown, but we probably have some trucks and equipment stuff downtown as well. That's helpful.
Any other discussion?
My only question is, do we need to do something? I mean, do we need to let
them know?
Can you
communicate our acquiescence to the county?
If four of you would like me to do that.
There's only five of us here.
Yeah, I'm not holding it up, but sure.
So do we need
as long as they plant a tree.
So we would like, do I need to make a motion then that we tell the county we're okay with them doing their curb cuts and sadly taking a tree out, and we'd be happy to accept a tree, a replacement tree?
Second.
Any objection? All those in favor of the lady's motion indicate by saying aye.
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 Anyone opposed? And next report is from Water and Light on electric meter standard change. Any comments you'd like to add, Director?
Yes. Just a little bit of background on this. The electric utility currently uses AMR or automated meter type of meters for the electric service, which means that we currently drive by the meters to get a reading off the meter. The electric utility industry has been moving toward AMIs, or what is known as advanced metering infrastructure type of meters. At this time, the EIA estimates approximately half of all the U.S. electric utility customers have these AMI type of meters. This report is to share with Council our plan to change our current meter standard from the existing AMR type of meters to the AMI type of meters. The use of AMI meters will Meters have progressed to where they are less expensive of an alternative for us to buy these new type of electric meters and also allow a safer method to disconnect and reconnect electric service. This change will not be changing the way we currently read meters, and we will maintain our existing processes for customer notifications. The Water and Light Advisory Board has considered and recommended this change, and the climate action planning process currently underway has a recommendation to support this change. There are ordinances that do allow for non-standard electric meters to be used if a customer requests it. So with that, to answer any questions about the standard meter change that we're looking to undergo.
Any questions, Mr. Trapp?
I have a couple.
For what reason do you seek recognition? I've
got a couple questions.
Would you yield to an inquiry?
Yes.
He does proceed.
Let's see, now I can remember what my questions are. So we charge significantly more to have service reinstated on evenings and weekends. If this is going to become just a flip in the switch in headquarters versus sending a crew out to put a meter back on, would we want to re-examine our fees that we charge for reconnection?
One of these days that may be the case, but like I said, right now there's really nothing changes except we're doing a different meter. We're still going to have to dispatch a crew to the site. We'll still have to drive by the place to read the meters. When we actually get these new AMI type meters, they will actually be programmed as AMR because that's all the infrastructure we have to use them. Someday when we actually have a collection system or a system that ties them all together, then we might look at that one of these days. But that's not part of the change that we're proposing here today. This is just the change in the metering standard. Everything else will remain the same.
Gotcha. Two, I know the last time when we talked about the smart grid that we weren't a big enough utility to be able to benefit from those kind of technologies. Is the cost coming down on that? Is that
what it has? It has. As a matter of fact, these new AMI meters are actually going to cost us less than the AMRs we have been using, which is really the driving force behind making this standard change, because we're going to be able to pay less for the meters that have more functionality today and have a safety benefit today, and we'll have some potential for improvements to our customers in the future.
So the AMI meters would be, then we would then need like a reading network to
Correct.
Be able to read more at a near constant rate to adjust pricing based on demand times, and then we could really
Right.
start to save some energy.
Yeah, and those are two very big pieces to the puzzle, is actually the collection network and the whole head-in system that takes all this information and actually controls it all. Those are two very big pieces of the puzzle. We have to understand how they're going to work, and they will be costly to get done.
And how long will it take to change over the AMR meters to AMI? I assume we're just replacing with AMI?
We are just changing the standard, so they will just happen as it would naturally occur, as either the old ones wear out, need to be replaced, become inaccurate, or we just plain need new ones. So we're just changing the standard. We're not doing a system change out as such.
So if we need to disconnect or reconnect services, then we would look and see whether we have to send a crew out if they have an AMR meter. And if we put a new one in, we might put an AMI meter, and we would use up. And so it would be a long process to switch over.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. That's a good step. I'm excited to see it moving forward. Until we can get a handle on demand, we'll never be able to significantly reduce. You know, we're treading water with growth. We're absorbing all the growth through efficiency. But when we really want to start to roll back our carbon footprint, we're going to need to control demand, and this will be a good tech. We'll need these at all the houses or almost all the houses. There's the five hardline folks.
Dr. Peters.
The chart that you have here says the proposed AMI meters, no meter readers on the property for either type, AMR, AMI, outage detection, the proposed AMI meters, you can do that remotely?
No, as far as outage detection, we will not have that capability now. It will take a collection network and some of the other pieces I take to be able to have it. It will have the capability that someday we could make it there if we put the collection and the control network in place. But as of right now, they will really just function as AMRs.
Okay. Third one on the list that says remote on, off, which would allow you to switch things on from a central control place, would not happen either until you get an umbrella.
Right, but what we will be able to do is, just like we do now, where we go to the people's house, the customer's house, and we'll knock on the door and we'll say, we are here to, you know, because we need to look at disconnecting your service because of the bill issue. We will not have to go to the house and pull the meter. Right now, we actually have to physically go to the meter and pull the meter, which is a arc hazard, and there's an electrical exposure element to that that we will be able to eliminate. So they'll be able to on-off it from the curb, but we'll still do the same processes. We'll still go to the house. We'll still talk to the customer. We just won't have to pull the meter.
Okay. Thank you.
And, Director, are these considered smart meters?
Yes.
And is there an opt-out provision for the consumer to decline?
Yes, our ordinances, a few years ago we put the opt-out provision, and all they have to do is notify us, and we can put a non-standard meter provision in there, and we can put a non-standard meter in. There is a slight charge for going out and making the change out, and so it's a little bit more cost monthly, but we do have that option for them.
Do we inform the consumer of their right to opt out?
Yes.
How do we do that?
I know it's in our ordinances, and I believe at the time we made the change, we actually mailed that out to our customers at the time we make the change. I don't know if there's an ongoing notification process where we do that every year, but at the time that we made the change, it was notified.
Do we notify customers, and I believe we do because someone brought this to my attention, that that we are be changing their meter to
Yes.
one of these meters? And is it clear in that communication with them that they can opt out?
It will be. I will make sure that notification as it goes out to make sure they know we're changing this style of meter, that the opt-out provision is available.
And do these smart meters allow the department to collect more data on utilization by individual consumers?
They could someday. If you actually have the collection network in and the back office systems to be able to do that, the way we run them, it won't be any different than what we do right now, which is we're just doing monthly reads on them.
Do we collect and retain data on utilization by customer, by hour, or?
Not at this time, no. We just do monthly reads.
But that capacity exists?
In these new meters, it could, but we won't set them up that way. They'll just be set up as AMR meters.
Is it your intent to set them up that way in the future?
Only if we get to a network provision. In other words, if we do all the other work to get the collection network and the control network and everything put in place, so it would take some significant expenses to get there.
And is there any current city ordinance that prevents the city from sharing any data that we collect or selling any customer data on utilization?
I'd look over to Councilor over here. I know we've talked about that, but I don't think there's anything that actually prevents us from sharing this information.
And to the extent that it's a public record, it would be publicly available to anybody upon request.
To ponder that. Any other inquiry? Any other questions? Moving on to the interdepartmental transfer of funds request. Any comments on or questions on non-capital or capital transfers? Seeing none. Is there anyone from moving on to? I don't know what to do with myself at 5 till 8. General comments by the public. Is there anyone from the public that would like to address City Council? Seeing none, are there any comments by council members?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin.
I would like to respond to the request that Ms. Hubbard presented regarding the Nora Stewart Early Learning Center. I wanted to just say that Nora Stewart is a very valuable and historic institution in the African-American community located in the First Ward. I know firsthand that many of the children who attend represent in many instances second and third generations within their families that have attended Nora Stewart. And as that, and because of that, I know that over an 88-year period that any organization will have seasons when they are doing extremely well and seasons when they face significant challenges. But in the history of Nora Stewart, each time there has been a moment when they have been in transition, the community has rallied together to support them and to ensure that this institution will be available for the generations that are coming after them. As I see the proposal that is presented to council today, I see it as an opportunity to reinvigorate the energy of Nora Stewart and to allow the location of this facility to be a gathering place that will have an outreach not only into the families that are connected directly to the Learning Center, but also to those in the surrounding community and also to the entire city by providing an essential service that is critical in terms of our strategic plan. I know that I've dealt with many families who are struggling with the challenges of reentry, and anything that can be done that will strengthen the families, give the children a sense of hope and expectation, and also facilitate the process of reentry, successful reentry, is an incredible opportunity, not only for the city, but also for North Stuart to be the place where it can happen. And so I would like to direct staff to prepare an ordinance authorizing an agreement between the City of Columbia and North Stuart Early Learning Center for the following programs: creating lasting family connections, the fatherhood program, family reintegration, and the marriage enhancement program, transferring $33,355 from the council contingency to fund these programs, with the ordinance having specific safeguards within the ordinance to ensure the organization and the success as well as the implementation of these programs.
Any discussion on the gentleman's motion?
Does it need to be seconded?
Is there a second?
I would second.
Seconded. Mm-hmm.
I have just questions. Is this a one-year program? Is this the $30,000 for 1 year? Is this?
It's 1 year.
Okay. And there was a description of this. Is this replacing? Is this an addition to what Nora Stuart is doing now with their early childhood learning program?
It expands what they're doing.
It expands. And how many people do we think, how many people are we anticipating that this would help? I mean, is it a certain amount, you know, is it? So there's 25 families enrolled in Nora Stuart or enrolled in these three programs?
No, at Nora
Stuart. At Nora Stuart.
Right.
And then you're.
This is a new initiative for North Stuart. They have not offered it before.
Okay. And then after the first year, is this going to be an ongoing?
Almost all startup expense.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Ms. Hubbard looked at me when she gave her presentation because I launched a Curating Lasting Families Connection program when I was at Phoenix Programs. So I've been through the training. I almost wore my CLFC shirt tonight, but I forgot. So it's an excellent program. There are very few evidence-based prevention programs. So almost all of it's startup costs because it's buying the materials, and then once you have those and go through the trainings and get your folks certified, absent any significant staff turnover, then you're golden to be able to present that material indefinitely. So it's really startup costs because Ted that comes out and or another presenter from his agency, they're small. And they do a week-long training, and then there's kind of some follow-up mentorship as you do the program. So the first-year cost would be a lot higher. And I think that there would be other funding systems that might, if we wanted to jumpstart this program, then, and it has clear strategic plan implications, they would likely be able to get ongoing funding from other sources. It seems like something that the Boone County Children's Services Fund would, I know that they funded Phoenix's program. Where Phoenix struggled, and this is the reality piece, is in recruitment. Because reaching out kids who don't already have a drug problem and getting their parents who don't have a problem yet to come to a weekly class, we found very, very challenging. So you're going to want to do some additional things like incentives. And if you have an existing, and I'm not as familiar with your organization, but if you have an existing culture that can turn out parents, you might have a head start than what Phoenix had. I'm supportive of this. Seems council reserves. It seems like it might be a good use of that. And then we would have if that was an ordinance, then there would be a public hearing where they could offer more evidence about what they're going to do about recruitment and those kinds of things.
And is there evidence? Is this an evidence-based program?
It is, yeah. And President Trump, bless his heart, did away with the evidence-based program list from SAMHSA, but when we had a rational approach to national social services, that is a Gold Star program that was on that list. And I don't even sure if that website exists anymore at the federal level, but I can tell it is. There's a strong evidence basis for it. It's a very effective program. And there is, and it's teaches, it's based in family skills, so it's protective factors, that, and then there's some direct education about drugs and alcohol. But it's primarily like dinner, eating dinner together, and the exercises are based on strengthening family connections is the theoretical basis for it. So it has a strong theoretical basis, and he's done a nice job on, this has been replicated across the country with lots of different populations. And so it's definitely an excellent program.
How was your CLFC program reimbursed?
We had a grant, so it was. I'm trying to remember how who funded it.
Was it state DMH? Was it?
No, it was not. It was a grant program. It wasn't part of Phoenix's core programming.
Through Boone County Children's Fund.
Could have been.
Have you applied for Boone County Children's funding for this program? We have a nationally recognized children's services tax in Boone County that seems like this would be right up their alley to fund. My concern is more about the process that, you know, we have a lot of very worthy not-for-profit programs in the city, and I don't know that I want to choose one over the other for precious public funding without some type of process. And we kind of have that through the CDBG program. We have it a little bit through our budget hearings. When the STEM Alliance came up, we all agreed to do an RFP for that. So I have more questions than anything as to, are we the funder of last resort? Are there other agencies that could be applied for? And if the problem is low enrollment on the preschool side, I'm not sure introducing an alcohol and drug treatment program is into that preschool setting is going to be an effective enrollment strategy.
It's a prevention program, not a treatment program.
We can have more discussion on it, and it sounds like there's a Mr. Thomas.
I'm going to support the motion to direct the staff to bring an ordinance, but I share the same concerns that you have about undermining a process that we do have. And I want to emphasize that it sounds like an absolutely top-notch program, and there sounds to be no question that there is a need and there will be a benefit to implementing the program at Nora Stewart and in the Central City. And I have the greatest admiration for you, Cheryl, and Judy and Glenn, who are advocating for this program. But when, assuming that this comes back as an ordinance, what I'll have to weigh is the impact on a process that Steve Hollis with the Human Services Department and the Human Services Commission, working with the United Way and the Boone County Mental Health Children's Tax, Kelly Wallace, have developed to really try to be data-driven and to look at the community as a whole and use our limited social service and human service dollars to the greatest impact. And I'm quite concerned about undermining that process, which we have done on this council several times before, and I was concerned about all of those situations as well. So I'm on board for now, but we'll presumably have another public hearing and another discussion at a future meeting.
Sure. Any objection to the gentleman's motion?
So did we vote on the motion?
Not yet.
There's a motion and a second. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Aye. Anyone opposed? Seeing none. I'd like to know more about it. Any further comments by council members?
Mr. Trapp.
Thank you. We had a presentation about a pilot for ADUs, accessory dwelling units, yes. And just wanted to see if there was anything we could do to get a status update, or when are we look like bringing that forward?
Oh, beautiful.
What, the second meeting in November about the
ADU pilot?
Well, not the ordinance change.
Right.
Got it. Okay.
So, well, okay. So that's like the gravel driveways and
yes.
Okay. Will that be in a report, or are we still kind of?
I believe it's just going to come back with
an ordinance.
An ordinance
or a resolution.
Okay. That's fine. Just the second meeting in November, knowing that there's a date.
Those ordinance changes have to come through the Planning Commission, so you'll see it on the Planning Commission agenda before it hits here.
Okay.
They come in ordinance form, so I haven't looked at the Planning Commission agenda to see if that's the case, but that's where you'd see it next.
So you still think it's second meeting in November?
But it may just be a report.
Not the second meeting in November as an intro item if it still has to go through PNC.
I think it's a report on they want an indication from council whether to proceed in this manner is what we're going to get on the second meeting in November. Does that sound right, Chris? Okay.
You can let me know. That's fine. Okay. I'll assume it's a report, and if I hear different, then you can let me know.
So looking back at our minutes, that was from the July 16th meeting, and it looks like council directed staff to begin drafting a program for council review. Would that typically come back as a report, or should that come back as an ordinance?
I mean, I would think if staff wanted more input from council on exactly what this would look like, they might bring it as a report.
So, I mean, there were people at the time, as I recall, that were kind of in a pinch with the driveway issue and some utility connects, and were trying to decide whether to move forward and if it's going to be next year.
Scheduled for the second meeting in November. Is there any way to get it on as an? Oh no, it has to go through planning and zoning. You said.
So yes. So I'm checking to see if Tim's still within distance.
There he is.
Excellent.
Because yeah, it seems like this has
been
a couple
months. I heard your discussion. I have planned an ordinance that would implement a pilot program on waiver of fees. I understood that a suspension of fees would not require planning and zoning
okay.
involvement. However, the parking and the driveway standards, that would. So there'll probably be a report that refers those latter items to the P&Z, but this 30 units or 3 years suspension of building-related fees, that could be an ordinance.
But on November 19th.
City councilor tells me otherwise.
That is correct. The fee issue can be an
okay.
ordinance. It comes directly to
so
council.
So it's both that an ordinance and a report.
You're all right. You're all correct. Sorry for the confusion.
Well, so then the question still becomes, how quickly can we get this through? When can it go through planning and zoning? And then when can it come to council? Because there are people that I think... Don't they have mortgages to pay for these ADUs?
Yeah,
and yet
construction on his ADU has stopped because he's waiting.
Yeah, and that's a different matter if it's something that's already started. But usually a change in standards is going to affect the next plan that you have. Now, we could do some kind of an exception for, a variance or something like that for an existing construction situation.
Because I think right now we're just talking about two dwellings, aren't we?
Two, yeah.
I mean, this, you know, it's not 30 units. I know it's an exception, but how can we more aggressively address this issue?
It's a deliberate process, and we've amended the ADU standards before. We've had lots of discussion with it each time it's gone to the Planning and Zoning Commission, including the parking issue when we first formed the standards. There was a lot of discussion on it. One situation might not need any parking, but there's some other neighborhoods that are have issues with parking, so that was a concern. But the process is designed to be done in three steps: referral to the Planning and Zoning Commission, right, public hearing, and then they'll present a recommendation to you on those items.
So this was referred in July. So is it a three-month turnaround then to get it to Planning and Zoning, and then another month to City Council?
Or? We will have to advertise it as an amendment to a specified text of the zoning ordinance.
And so is Planning and Zoning meets twice a month?
Correct.
And we would need to advertise that then a week before that?
It's a 15-day notice.
And so when is the next opportunity to do that?
Well, if what you're talking about is referring it to the commission now, we'll probably have to have a December hearing because they meet one more time in October and then they'll meet once in November. They do not meet around the Thanksgiving holiday.
And we can't get it on the November Planning and Zoning Commission meeting?
I don't think we can with our notification deadline. I can look at that, but we'd have to prepare the amendments. Because once you put a notice out, people are going to ask what do the amendments look like.
Right. I guess it's just sort of frustrating that this came up in July.
Understood.
And it just appears that absolutely nothing is happening, and nothing is going to happen in spite of the fact that people wanted to do ADUs. And now it's just, we're going to put enough barriers in the way that this can't be done, but then we're going to say, oh, well, we'll get around to it sometime. I don't know how to make this work any better, or if there's any other options that you guys can think of, or if...
What would be a good way to explain this to our constituent who's waiting?
I would seek specific relief for that situation.
I think that's what she did at the July 6th meeting.
So how can we do that then if we need specific relief for this one or these two?
We look at the site, we look at the characteristics of the neighborhood, the site itself, what's the size of the ADU that's being proposed.
And we being the Planning and Development Department?
Well, the Board of Adjustment hears variance cases.
So, and that's what, like $300 or something to put something up through the...
And they have to be represented by an attorney.
I don't know, though, that they do if they're not developers. They don't have to...
I don't know if the rules have changed, but when we were... the clerk's office oversaw Board of Adjustment, the property owner could represent him or herself. If it was a corporation or LLC, then they had to have an attorney, but a property owner could represent him or herself.
What I'm talking about is a text amendment. If we change the parking ratio, that's going to apply to each one of these, so each one of them will get the benefit of that. So I'm just suggesting to you that that's something that the commission will probably want to analyze carefully. They may very well come out with the same opinion as the person that approached the council, but is a topic of discussion whenever we amend a standard such as parking.
So at this point, for these two people, the recommendation, your recommendation would be that they go through Board of Adjustment?
I think if they have a project, I know one has been under construction, the other one I believe is planned construction, so I would say that's probably the best relief, unless they're in a position where they can await the change in the text.
I think one is basically completed, except for the driveway.
Yeah, Yeah, and I think in that situation, there was a widening of the driveway to accommodate some emergency access concerns, and I think that's why it's perceived as a hardship, because they've done an excess of, in their opinion, they've done an excess of paving already.
Right.
Makes sense to move the fee portion if we don't have to run that through planning and zoning. And when we did the original ADU, there was a lot of discussion. It was narrowed a number of times. And so we've only heard from the folks who want them. When it comes forward, we're going to hear from the folks who are concerned about parking issues. I think there's a consensus that we want to move it as quickly as we can, but we can't hold up. I mean, we should do the fee portion and see if that is enough, and then the other one we have to just go through in a deliberate process.
This won't make anyone feel better, but the policy-making process is set up on purpose to work this slowly. So we're following all of the process and the ordinance, and it will be thoroughly vetted. I think we were talking about the change in our approach to zoning for how many years, Tim, did we go through the update of the...
Well, a long time. It was 2.5 years to get the almost, UDC developed.
Yeah, three after we... So yeah. I know it's irritating when you're trying to do something and then the policy's not there yet, so... This is working about as fast as it can on the policy level.
Anything further, Mr. Trapp?
Thomas.
A couple of things. I was very happy to support the voluntary downzoning of the 46 or so properties in the West Ash area. I do think that's a good way to preserve neighborhood character, to preserve historic homes, affordable housing within the heart of neighborhoods. But I do want to wave the flag, beat the drum, for more density at the nodes and along the edges of the neighborhoods, along the main arterials, and especially where those arterials intersect. And I know that the West Ash neighborhood plan shows some different options around zoning requirements on those corners. And I want to encourage residents and council members to sort of consider the benefits of encouraging denser, taller buildings there, mixed use, getting rid of parking requirements, let developers put in parking if they feel it's needed, but don't require it. Try to create some pedestrian-oriented, transit-oriented nodes there that will also provide great amenities within walking distance for the residents in the hearts of the neighborhood. I understand now there's quite a substantial sum in the residential parking permit program fund that we set up with a parking fee increase, 2 years ago. It seems like quite a while. Maybe it was just a year ago.
Yes, I think the money started about a year ago.
So yeah, okay. So I would like to request that staff start to work with the neighborhoods along Garth, East and West Parkway, Stewart Road, Westmount, that have a lot of parking from students and other university people in the neighborhood, and create a residence parking permit program for that area to better manage parking in that neighborhood.
Well, here's another good example of something that's painfully long coming, right?
Right.
A lot of work has happened. Just talked to the team today, and we're going to prepare a report that outlines everything that has happened, give you the timeline. And we are, I believe, finally at the jumping off point where we can have those conversations.
So what has happened is sort of creating a structure for this program?
That's right. An RFP, a subsequent hiring of a firm to design it after a lot of public input. So the idea is they'll go get this public input from a lot of different neighborhoods.
Okay.
And then we'll have this program we can then manage. So it's
At the starting point.
All right. Can you give me a time frame for the next step? Now we're at the starting point.
The report is coming soon. And then the firm is already engaged. And so
an RFP has been issued and a firm's already been hired?
Yes.
Okay.
And I can't for life me remember the name of the firm, but they are on board and they've started. And so this report will lay out, here's the next steps, here's where they're going to do over the next year.
And the report will come?
I'll email you when we, yeah.
All right, thanks.
And is the expectation, I don't want to butt in too much, but we already have a residential parking program, don't we, for North Village or?
Yep.
That area, and is the expectation that this parking permit system would be different?
I think it's supposed to systematize it for multiple neighborhoods going forward, make it more.
So that we can apply it to more than one neighborhood rather than.
It's been incredibly slow to get the North Village one. I think your neighborhood is still sort of stalled. Benton Stevens, I think, maybe stalled.
No, Benton Stevens. I mean, they wanted to go forward. I'm not sure.
But
how
I don't think
it's stalled.
Happened yet, has it?
It hasn't happened.
Okay, I'm just.
But I don't know what the.
Well, I can share some information that
won't
make you feel better, but it is the facts of the history. The report will be on the next meeting.
Oh, great.
So it's that soon. Neighborhoods don't tend to agree on the type of program. And so if you remember, there's a significant use of parking meters at this one that
North
the neighborhood
Village.
Was comfortable with. Yeah, North Village neighborhood. And none of the other neighborhoods are. So, you know, the idea was, well, how do we pay for this program? You solve that problem with an action. I think it might have been 2 years ago that started actually collecting money 1 year ago. Or we decided 1 year ago, and now we have. Anyway, all those details will be in the report. However, a lot of it is, we have 80-some-odd neighborhoods, and we frankly can't manage 80-some-odd programs. So we're trying to have one citywide that works for everyone. It may be that we end up taking the meters out where we have them before. It may be that we leave them, but that the future doesn't utilize them. I think that's the one thing that neighbors do agree on is they don't want meters in their neighborhood.
Except for North Village.
Right. And I don't know, you know, things change over time. So long story short is this process will take those things people can agree on, create a vision of the future that is hopefully compelling, and then we can implement after that.
Right. Nothing from me. Thank you.
I want some input from the council. Since it appears that we need to talk about the transportation, or I would like to talk about the transportation budget, where the transportation money is coming from and where it's going. I'd like to look at the bus system, and I'd like to go over the report. And maybe you guys have read it and digested all of it, but it helps me to read it and then talk to people about it. And I'm wondering if we could perhaps do this for a couple of the pre-council meetings.
Which report are you referring to, Betsy?
It's Olson. Is it the Olson?
Oh, report? The transit, yeah.
The transit report.
Olson Associates Transit Consultant.
The transportation
report.
Part of the budget, what the plans are, what we've already voted on, that we're going to change the bus system to, the immoral budget that has come up, but just... Could we take a couple of pre-council meetings and talk about the transportation budget and our goals for the bus system, you know, not at the end of the meeting, although tonight's a lovely early meeting, so this would not be a bad time to talk about it, but to do it as a pre-council meeting and talk about the report and talk about how we're changing our current bus system, how we're funding it, what our plans are in the future. It would just be nice to have a conversation about that, and it appeared to me that maybe one of the two-hour pre-council meetings would be a good time to do that.
I really support that. Thank you.
I figured you would, but I'm not sure if anybody else does, but I appreciate you supporting it.
I would. I'd like to learn more about it, and, you know, the other thing, as I mentioned, a lot of stakeholders here, I understand. That person ought to be given the benefit of
part of the conversation?
Clearly, and competition. All the other stakeholders with businesses, the university, private charter providers, the disability community, the faith community, all of the people that came up and, were concerned about this issue, minimum, we ought to figure out, maybe there's a technology provider. I'm happy to do that. I think that's a good idea. One of the things that we all agreed is that nobody liked these cuts, but it gave us 6 months.
So is this helpful? Perhaps we could do a one-hour session that we present everything we can find on transit that we've done in the past, give that to you as information, and then collect the open questions that you have, prepare a deeper dive for the second meeting that then are able to answer some of the questions or lay out different scenarios that would address certain concerns, et cetera. So it's two-pronged.
Could we that like the same month? Could we do the presentation? To some extent, I get somewhat overwhelmed with some of those presentations. It's a lot of bits and pieces, but it's not a very deep dive into something. And then, if we have questions, could we then come back while we still remember the first presentation? I hate to admit that, but,
We may need to give the staff some time to prepare responses and to think about the second meeting. I would say maybe a month apart.
There will be a significant amount of information to dump in on your lap, so you may want a little more time. But we're happy to set it up how you like it.
I would like at least one of them to be a two-hour block, because I think the 1 hour has a tendency to be a lot of information, and then we have to run off to the city council.
And coming forward, we're getting very close to the. We have a few things we have to do in. December, and so it may be after then before we get this prepared. That's the labor negotiation process.
December?
I believe so, yeah.
Well, what about November? We just missed our two-hour pre-council meeting because whatever reason. Could we do this in November? I would rather not push it right up against the budget because we need to think about it, or maybe at least one of those meetings. Maybe not. If you want a month difference, maybe.
Have the first one in November.
Second one in January or something?
December or January.
I think we need to look at it sooner rather than later because we are changing our bus system in July.
We are. We also have a new transit director.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I guess we should let them start.
And it would be good to let Leah Christian kind of. I think it would be good to get her in front of us as soon as possible to talk about these issues initially.
Should be able to do November for the initial.
Okay.
Yeah. Transit parking. Isn't that awesome?
That'll give her a week.
And then I had another one, too, sadly. Same general idea. Is the water and electric departments or the electric linemen or whatever, that ongoing issue we have where I guess we're supposed to get a report on what we pay versus what other places pay. Is that showing up in 2 weeks also?
Yes, it's coming. I don't think it's going to show up in 2 weeks, but we don't have that information, so we need to go analyze it and then.
I guess I need an education on that because isn't it what other departments in the Midwest in our state pay? So
yes.
How long does that take to get that together?
We have a company on that we hire to help us with these sorts of analyses. The level of deep dive here may be beyond the scope, so we're analyzing, would this take an amendment to the contract, or can we just use the one we have, or if it's going to need a whole new RFP or what?
Oh, to get them to do the evaluation.
That's right.
Oh, so we haven't started that yet.
We've started the staff review. It's in HR, and they're looking at, can it be a relatively quick analysis, or does it need to be more drawn out? Comply with all the purchasing laws.
Okay, I'll leave that to you. My last issue is I was approached by the East Campus Traditional Neighborhood Association interest group that met about a month ago. And they're interested in having some banners hung in the East Campus on the street lights or, you know, the light poles, similar to what Stevens College does or any of the other.
NCID.
Right, right. Thank you. All the other people that put banners up. And they were, I forwarded the information to Nancy about the types of banners they're talking about and where they want them placed. And we think there's enough information for you to go ahead and generate an ordinance. If there's more information they need to provide, let us know.
And well, and after you sent that to me, I pulled up that information, and it's possible that that's another one of those issues that might have to go through the Planning and Zoning Commission, because okay. It is in chapter 29?
Well, that is not a rush. That's more just sure. They're interested in doing that and wanted to get the ball started. We're quite excited that we could get the ball started. So it can roll slowly along through planning and zoning.
It's a deliberative process.
There you go. And that's it for me.
Anything further? I move we adjourn.
Oh, man, this is the first time you beat my over-under.
I was trying to...